WHYY is proudly supported by Penn Medicine. From groundbreaking discoveries to life-saving care, Penn Medicine's innovation is helping to change lives, one moment, one treatment, one patient at a time.
The National Book Critics Circle Award for Poetry was presented this week to America's Poet Laureate, Robert Hass. Hass is not only a great poet, he's a great teacher and translator. His love of language is contagious. His own work has been influenced by Japanese haiku. He edited a collection by three Japanese masters. When I spoke with him last year, I asked him what makes a haiku a haiku.
Well, that's a good question. Issa, who was a 19th century haiku poet, moved back to his father's farm when he was in middle age, and the local lord, Damyo in Japanese, wanted to honor his presence, so he sponsored a poetry contest with some fairly large prize on the theme of new snow. Each haiku has a seasonal word in it. It's a reference to some time of year that usually has traditional symbolic associations. New snow has associations with freshness and cleanness and purity. And so the poem that Basho wrote for this was went something like, writing crap about new snow for rich people is not haiku. In 17 syllables. On the theme of freshness and purity. It's a perfectly correct haiku. I think for most people, the definition of it involves plain language, an act of attention to the immediate moment. In Japanese, it was composed of 17 syllables and a kind of rhythmic units of five syllables, seven syllables, five syllables. And it intended to be mostly absolutely attentive to the present, and it had this element of seasonal reference always.
Would you recite a favorite for us?
Yeah. Well, one of my every Japanese poet had to write a poem at one time or another about Mount Fuji, and the greatest of the haiku poets, Basho, wrote one that goes, "Misty fall, can't see Fuji. Interesting." That was the first poem about not seeing Mount Fuji that got written.
Mm-hmm.
So I like that one.
You've translated a lot of haiku. What really appeals to you about the form?
Well, what appealed to me about it in the first place was just its clear-mindedness. You know, I just loved the clarity and plainness of the seeing. I didn't understand why later I came to see that, unlike most of Western poetry, it's not a theistic, it's not trying to read God's hand in creation. Not that I don't like this tradition, I love this tradition, but if you think about two New England poems, one that I love that's appropriate this time of year is Robert Frost's Nothing Gold Can Stay. Nature's first green is gold, her hardest hue to hold. It's only so an hour, then leaf subsides to leaf. So Eden sank to grief, so dawn goes down to day. Nothing gold can stay. That poem, which begins with this, you know, very specific observation that the first fuzz on the bare woods in early spring is a kind of sheen of gold, then goes on to moralize it in a specific way.
Right.
I think another great example of this tradition, it's really a tradition of New England Protestant inwardness, I think, one of the great poems in American speech is Emily Dickinson's Certain Slant of Light. You know, there's a certain slant of light winter afternoons that oppresses like the heft of cathedral tunes. Heavenly hurt it gives us, we can find no scar, but internal difference where the meanings are. None can touch it, any. 'Tis the sealed despair, an imperial affliction sent us of the air. When it comes, the landscape listens, shadows hold their breath. When it goes, 'tis like the distance on the look of death. She starts with that shaft of afternoon light and immediately goes inside to this kind of, shockingly modern, painful...
Inner desolation.
Yeah, inner desolation. And we talk about Emily Dickinson all day, a desolation that's preferable to deadness of feeling. I mean, in that poem, that seems like the two choices.
So in comparing this New England style that you're talking about with haiku is just more purely descriptive, more gazing outward than inward?
Well, I think there's a famous story about Basho that one of his students, Kikaku, came to him and showed him a poem, and Basho looked at it and shrugged and said, "The trouble with most poetry is that it's either objective or subjective." And Kikaku, the straight man, said, "You mean too objective or too subjective?" And Basho said, "No." So in theory, of course, it's like with that, I think it's true of any great art in a way, in some way anyway, that there's a kind of perfect fusion of the outer and inner in the best of it, wherever it seems to be located. Later, he would write poems that would go, this one has a little title, "At a Monastery." "Late fall getting dinner, we peeled cucumbers, eggplants."
Right, now that seems like, in some way, just such a factual recording.
Yeah. So many times his poems just say, is.
Uh-huh.
Here's being. You don't have to be in torment for it to be real to you. You don't have to push it up against mortality for it to be real to you, because it's always pushed up against mortality.
There's a haiku of Basho's that I particularly love that you've included in your anthology of haiku. I'm going to ask you to read it for us. It's about the summer moon.
Yeah. "It's not like anything they compare it to. The summer moon is the whole poem."
I just think that's so lovely.
Yeah. The poem, the one poem of his that does this inward turn that I know, I mean, there are a few actually, but is one that I love, goes, "Deep autumn, my neighbor, how does he live, I wonder?"
Mm-hmm.
I think he could be a powerful psychologist even in this tiny form sometimes. He has another poem that goes, the famous thing, like the cherry blossoms in Washington, the famous thing about spring in Japan was the cuckoo birds in Kyoto, and people would go to Kyoto to see the cuckoos. So, which were Himalayan cuckoos, migratory birds that only hit Japan in the early spring. And he has a poem that goes, "Even in Kyoto, hearing the cuckoos cry, I long for Kyoto."
I like that one a lot, too.
I do, too.
Yeah, that the reality is never quite measures up to.
I don't know if it doesn't quite measure up to, I don't know if the reality doesn't quite measure up to, but, or to defend ourselves against a reality, we rehabilitate desire instantly to put ourselves back in our real condition, which is permanent longing.
Yes, right. The real condition of permanent longing. Well put. In your anthology of haiku, you included Basho's death poem. I'm going to ask you to recite that. And what does it mean, his death poem? Did he know he was dying?
Yes, he did know he was dying. And in his last years, he was sort of troubled. He came to feel like he should really be involved in religious practice and stop this frivolous business of writing poetry. And he just couldn't stop writing poetry. The seasonal phrase in this poem is "the withered fields." It means uncultivated fields. The English translations of this, British translations always say moor to distinguish it from crop fields, but it means withered fields. Has a peculiar sense of desolation for the Japanese in the 17th century. And this poem goes, "Sick on a journey, my dreams wander the withered fields." And I think he knew he was dying, and I think that though he was a religious poet and he wanted to come to a sense of peace, he saw himself dying at the end with this machine of longing in him still throwing up images, still trying to make poetry. "Sick on a journey, my dreams wander the withered fields."
That's really beautiful. Now, in your own writing, having read and translated so many haiku, did you ever try to write haiku yourself, or have you just written things that are inspired by haiku but don't take the form of haiku.
I sometimes think what I write are very long haiku. You know? And every once in a while I've tried to write them. There's a poem of mine that goes, late summer, beach towels drying on a fence, no wind. The apricots have blossomed and been picked. The blackberries have blossomed and been picked. In some way, I felt like that was the nearest I came. Or in something like, there's a little poem that goes, the child is looking in the mirror. His head falls to one side, his shoulders slump. He's practicing sadness. often for me, they don't come out of nature at all. There's another one that goes, if you ever leave me, she says, and marry a younger woman and have another baby, I'll put a knife in your heart. They're in bed, so she climbs directly on his chest and looks down into his eyes. You understand? Your heart. Sometimes I feel like I can just do something like what the haiku does, which is have something like an immediacy of presentation that isn't just pictorial.
Mm-hmm,
you know?
Mm-hmm.
I think I decided not to be a quote nature poet because I came to feel like if I wanted to have my world exist in poetry in that way, the best way to do it would not be able to go out and announce I'm going to write a poem about Pierce Point or I'm going to write a poem about Point Reyes. It's to write about loss, grief, divorce, pain, failure, unexpected joy, good luck, and let the images of my world come up naturally as ways of expressing it.
Now, all the poems that you've recited for us today, you've done from memory.
Mm-hmm.
So obviously there's a lot of poetry that you just carry around in your mind.
Yeah.
Now, I know when I was in school and I was supposed to memorize a poem, it would be work to memorize it. I don't have a good memory. Are these poems that you have worked to commit to memory, or do they just stay with you?
I think probably they're all ones that just stay with me. There are poems, lots of poems, that I've committed to memory and worked at it. And I believe even with college students, I never teach a poetry class in which I don't ask them to memorize at least three poems. Partly on the theory that what I say to them is going to be like duck off water off a, this is a great metaphor, isn't it? Water off a duck's back. Have you ever heard that one?
No, never.
but that they go, you know, if they go away with the poems, they'll have got what they came for. So I like doing that. And I think that it's how we, you know, it's the ancient way that we made them at home in us.
Right. You know, I figure in a way that, to use a food analogy, if you are what you eat, that if you kind of like absorb poems or songs into your body, that somehow they transform you in some small but swell way.
I think so. You know, I mean, one hopes so. Of course, we also incorporate all kinds of awful language in our heads, and then language that is... who knows what purpose? You'll wonder where the yellow went if you brush your teeth.
That's an answer, isn't it? I got a lot of that in my mind.
Though some poets, you know, it was Lou Welch, one of the early beat poets, who wrote the famous haiku, "Raid Kills Bugs Dead."
Wait, who'd you say wrote that?
Lou Welch. You know, he was a comrade of Gary Snyder and
Allen
Ginsberg.
No, I had no idea.
And he worked briefly for an advertising agency in San Francisco in the 50s, and he is the author of that well-known haiku.
Well, Poet Laureate of the United States, is that well-written? It sure stuck in America's mind.
It's great, isn't it? It just says it. Raid kills bugs dead. Now that's my idea of poetry.
Robert Haas is America's Poet Laureate. His collection of poems, Sun Under Wood, won a National Book Critics Circle Award this week. Our interview was recorded last year.